Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It has no real business model, no way to make money off its customers, but it's got investors, and apparently it's worth $1.5 billion. Oh, and we are not talking about Facebook. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 17th of May. What we're talking about today is Pinterest. Now, this is a social network where users create these online scrapbooks. It has been touted as the next Facebook. And if it can just up its value by another $99 billion, give or take, it may have a shot. But right now, it's not so bad being Pinterest. It just nabbed $100 million in financing, and that puts its paper value at $1.5 billion for a company that has yet to earn a profit. Seems to be a lot of that going around these days. Sally Herships has our story.
Ben Silberman is a co-founder of Pinterest, and you know his mom pinned up his $1.5 billion news on Pinterest. That's what people do there, tack up digital pictures of things they like, anything from fried string cheese to a favorite t-shirt from Urban Outfitters. But those are just pictures, so where does the big money come in?
It certainly has nothing to do with any economic value that any rational economist could justify.
Scott Meadow teaches entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago. He says Pinterest's valuation is based on where we spend our time, or a good chunk of it, online. And yes, I'm talking about Facebook. Meadow says imagine it as your neighborhood, but digital.
That neighborhood needs infrastructure. That neighborhood needs marketing. That neighborhood needs all kinds of things.
Like bulletin boards. And so companies like Pinterest, whose users are multiplying by the millions, look promising to investors. So does the marketing potential. Every time someone posts a picture of a product, that's free advertising and a possible sale. Ben Schachter is an internet analyst at Macquarie.
You used to get home around dinner time, you'd eat dinner and then kind of plop yourself on the couch, and you were not on the internet.
Now Schachter says we're still on the couch, but with our phones, laptops, or tablets, which means more opportunities for shopping online. Pinterest got that $100 million investment from Japanese retailer Rakuten. The plan is to expand Pinterest globally. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And by the way, Facebook did set its IPO price this afternoon, $38 a share, set to raise $16 billion. Today, the Census Bureau told us that for the first time, more than half of the kids born in the U.S. are not European-descended whites. And minorities make up the majority of all residents in California, Texas, Hawaii, New Mexico, and Washington, D.C. Latinos are the fastest growing of these groups. They make up nearly 17% of the population. So that has got to be a marketing executive's dream, right? Big target audience getting even bigger? Well, maybe not. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Blair Borther says we've been here before. She runs Hispanic Marketing Resources, a consulting firm.
Every time the census data comes out, you will see a stampede from marketers trying to cash in on the Hispanic market.
But cuidado, watch out, says Borther. She's Mexican-American, U.S. born and educated. And just like her own family, she says the Latino market is multinational and multilingual. So surfing Univision TV, we have a fashion report in Spanish with some Spanglish thrown in. The story's about good-fitting jeans for women with curves. But will it appeal to the young Latinas it's targeted at? Tamar Jacoby runs Immigration Works, an advocacy group. She says the younger generation is moving away from this kind of messaging.
In the third generation, three-quarters of Hispanics can't even speak Spanish, can't even talk to their grandmother. They intermarry. By the second and third generation, many people whose parents were Latino no longer identify as Latinos.
So here's the problem for anyone trying to reach this audience, says Blair Borther. It's anything but homogeneous. South Americans don't speak Mexican Spanish and don't want to be marketed Mexican beer. And that's not even on the younger generation's grocery list.
Their parents consumed mostly beer. The more affluent U.S.-born Hispanic is now consuming wine.
Borthaire warns this is a market that doesn't want to be sold to like their immigrant parents and won't buy the same stuff anyway. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, for those of you who are wondering if things could get any worse for J.P. Morgan, well, apparently they could. That $2 billion loss the bank reported last week? Well, at the time, CEO Jamie Dimon said that figure could grow by another $1 billion or so. According to the New York Times, it took just a week to get there. How does one go about losing $1 billion in 1 week? We asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to check it out.
The only ones who can really explain how J.P. Morgan lost $1 billion in a week work at J.P. Morgan, and they're not talking. What we do know, J.P. Morgan is sitting on a lot of complex financial products known as derivatives, and those are losing value, says NYU economist Lawrence White. He says now J.P. Morgan has to find a buyer, and there aren't exactly a ton of potential buyers.
It takes, you know, at a minimum, tens of millions of dollars to be thinking about buying or selling in these kinds of markets.
Only big financial companies, hedge funds, investment banks are in that market, and they all know that J.P. Morgan needs to cut its losses. It's a little bit like trying to sell a house in the middle of a housing crash, says Max Wolf, an economist at Greencrest Capital.
If everybody begins to learn that buying a single family house is not, in fact, a fast way to get rich, but a fast way to get poor, then everyone starts to be nervous and demand discounts to buy a house.
Wolf says J.P. Morgan probably wants to sell to get this whole episode behind it, and other big banks would like this to go away, too.
This is reopening the wound around 2008, 2009. So this is a big deal because it reminds people that there's a murky world of unknown and dangerous things on bank balance sheets.
Of course, J.P. Morgan could hold on to those assets and hope for the bond markets to recover. But asset manager Michael Farr says waiting could lead to more losses.
Maybe this thing is better solved by tearing off the Band-Aid all at once than the slow tug.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a four-month low for the S&P. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Let's say you unplugged from all the noise, shut down your computer, turned off your TV, stopped reading the news. Come November, what do you think people are talking about? Well, probably the same thing they're talking about now.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said!
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup, and he's here every week to give us an attitude check on issues Americans care about most. Frank, good to have you back.
Good to be with you.
So, yet again, the economy is on voters' minds?
Oh, absolutely. Two-thirds, actually exactly 66% of Americans say it's the economy in general, or it's jobs or unemployment, or it's the deficit. Basically, the economy is overwhelmingly the dominant issue on voters' minds. There's no question about that.
Well, then let's talk about the presidential race. Given that issue, whom do Americans think might have an edge in getting the economy going?
Well, you know, it is Mitt Romney. One recent way that we asked it was, if Romney wins the election in 4 years, will the economy be better? And then we asked, if Obama wins the election in 4 years, will the economy be better? And there was a 9-point edge for Romney when it comes to handling the economy.
Does the poll give you any sense of why that is, why Romney has that edge?
You know, it's a good question, and we looked at it, and one thing that we find is that Romney does better than Obama in terms of being able to manage the government. Now, I have to point out that Obama does better on a lot of the softer dimension. He cares about people like you. He's more likable. Romney has an image as perhaps cold, calculating, a technocrat, but nevertheless somebody who can manage the government and do a better job in the economy. I think Obama's people know that, and that's why you've seen the commercials more recently, at least in swing states, that are trying to attack Romney on exactly that issue, going at his experience with Bain Capital.
Well, it certainly sounds like his image of being among the more wealthy in this country, shall we say, hasn't hurt him. Does it help him?
Well, over 80% of Americans say that Romney is rich. 66% say that Obama is rich, about that percent. So both men are perceived as rich. Whether or not that helps or hurts Romney and or Obama is a little difficult to tease out. I don't think it necessarily does, because some recent data we've talked about shows that Americans think it's good to have rich people in our country, and actually a lot of Americans wish they could be rich themselves.
Our partnership with Gallup is called Attitude Check, and you can check out the data behind the story at marketplace.org. Frank Newport, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Quiz show time. Which country had the fastest growing economy last year? Well, we can pretty much eliminate the one we live in. Europe doesn't have many eligible contestants at this point. So the answer is Mongolia. Didn't see that one coming, did you? Genghis Khan and yurts come to mind. But Mongolia is also home to one of the world's largest untapped deposits of coal. And that has not escaped the notice of its neighbor, China. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
Mongolia's recent discovery of a treasure trove of coal is sort of like discovering oil in your backyard. Your neighbors will soon come snooping around. Terrence Edwards of the Business Council of Mongolia says that can make you nervous.
It's a very small, remote population in a very large country, and they're very protective of their culture and their people and their resources.
Today, the Mongolian parliament will consider legislation to bar foreign state-owned companies from controlling Mongolia's resources. The bill is aimed at Chalco, a Chinese state-owned enterprise that has bought a controlling stake of one of the country's big coal mines. Dale Choi, Mongolian investment strategist for Frontier Securities, says this deal scares Mongolian politicians.
They don't want Chalco to be the buyer and the seller and the producer at the same time.
Choi thinks the bill might deter foreign investors, but by singling out Chinese firms, it might attract competing U.S. investors. Next month, Mongolia will hold national elections. Terrence Edwards says many Mongolians are pushing politicians to take a stand against their southern neighbor, which is having an increasing influence on Mongolia's economy.
China has 50.99% of all foreign investment into the country. And then you look at the next one, number two, that's Canada. And they have 8%. That's a huge difference.
Edwards says Mongolians are conflicted about China. Without China, Mongolia loses 80% of its import and export trade. But with China comes Chinese influence and control over Mongolia's precious national resources. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The group of eight richest industrialized nations meets at Camp David this weekend. On the agenda, the European debt crisis, among other issues. Commentator Ian Bremmer says real power in the world rests with a different group. All you do is subtract the G8 by eight.
We've entered the G0 world, where no single nation or alliance of governments can drive the international agenda. Before the financial crisis, we lived in the era of U.S.-led globalization, and the way for any country to succeed was to align itself with that process. But this era is over. In the G0, there isn't effective international coordination on today's most pressing challenges: climate change, nuclear proliferation, protectionist trade measures, resource scarcity, you name it. Absent a strong referee, the G0 is a more volatile, uncertain, and decentralized place. To succeed, nations need more than just growth, because growth can prove fleeting in a world where crises abound. Nations now need to be able to pivot easily between international partners. States that can pivot well are not overly reliant on any single power for their security or their economic health. Brazil's a great example. The United States was Brazil's largest trading partner for some 80 years, but over the last decade, Brazil increasingly courted China. Today, it trades more with China than the United States. Brazil's approach is the same as any good investment strategy: diversify. There are risks to trying to play both sides of the fence, to be sure. If Taiwan or Burma drifted too far from China, there would be repercussions. They know this. They'll reach out to the United States, but only to the extent that China will permit it. And that's why neither one is a pivot state. The risks preclude them from playing this game effectively at all. So what's all this mean for the United States? Despite debt problems and political gridlock, it's still the world's largest, richest economy, with strong political institutions and the rule of law. The U.S. still attracts more than its share of global investment, and that makes it hard for would-be pivot states to turn their back on it completely. The only problem? America's relative attractiveness in a G0 world allows it to procrastinate in solving the pressing challenges of tomorrow.
Ian Bremmer is president of Eurasia Group Consultants and author of the new book, Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. Tell us what you think. Head to marketplace.org and click on contact. Coming up, reading, writing, and saving the Eurozone.
Me and like the rest of the group are going to try and find a way to save Europe from economic calamity, essentially.
High school students play like the Euro Challenge. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. stocks fell a fifth day, sinking the Standard & Poor's to its lowest close since January. The Dow plummeted 156 points, 1.25% to finish at 12,442. The Nasdaq dropped 60 points, 2.1% to wrap up at 2813. And the S&P 500 retreated 19 points, 1.5%, ending at 1304. J.P. Morgan Chase peeled off 4.33%. B of A and Citigroup withdrew 1.8%, and Wells Fargo fell 1.6%. Apple sliced off nearly 3%. JCPenney tumbled another 3% on top of yesterday's 19% plunge. Bond prices ticked up. The yield on the 10-year T-note declined to 1.70%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In New York, have you heard? Facebook is expected to go public on the NASDAQ, but CEO Mark Zuckerberg won't be there to ring the bell. He'll be partying with employees at company headquarters in Silicon Valley. In Washington, a House subcommittee looks at terrorism financing since 9/11, and it's National Bike to Work Day. Grab your helmet and maybe a towel for when you get to the office. I'm Gina Delvac.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Been to a concert lately? Well, I'm guessing you ordered your tickets online and you probably paid a healthy service charge to do it. If you hate those fees, welcome to the party. Jam band The String Cheese Incident has spent years fighting Ticketmaster. So ahead of their upcoming show at the Greek Theater here in L.A., the band bought up a bunch of tickets from the box office, then scalped them to fans at cost on their website. Keith Mosley joins us to talk about it. He is the band's bass player. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So how exactly did you guys pull off this stunt? What'd you do?
After we went through our own allotment of tickets, there was still quite a demand from our fan base, from our hardcore fan base. And so we actually sent some people from our management office out to L.A., wired them $20,000 and had them recruit some friends to go stand in line and gave them each a handful of cash and had them buy tickets. The old-fashioned way, stand in line at the box office.
Right. And this is because you had an agreement with the Greek to have some tickets that did not go through Ticketmaster.
Correct. Yeah, we do that typically with all the venues we play. That sometimes we're forced to jump through some hoops to make it happen, and that's kind of what happened to us here with the L.A. Greek show.
Well, this is certainly not the first time that you have tried to make an end run around Ticketmaster. I don't know, is this a cause for you, would you say, as a band?
It is. We've really tried to cultivate our whole band experience around creating an intimate relationship with our fans. And early on, we created our own ticketing company, our own merchandise company, travel agency for fans that wanted to travel and see the band. So the ticketing thing has been part of our operating system from the beginning.
This is something you're losing money on, though, right? Didn't you eat part of the cost?
We are eating the cost. To us, it's worth it.
So you're going to plan to do this, try to do this for every show?
You got to kind of figure out what the deal is and work within the parameters of different venues. But yeah, we do plan to continue to sell our own tickets, as many as possible, as many as we can. The fans that are clued into this really seem to appreciate it and have told us continually that they would rather deal directly with us, support the band, pay less money for the same ticket than have to go through Ticketmaster.
Keith Mosley, bassist for the band The String Cheese Incident. Thanks so much for coming in and break a leg.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
So let's see. We have the Greek economic tragedy, the fate of the euro, fears of a run on Spanish banks. Yep, Europe is once again making the wrong kind of headlines. Well, the politicians over there don't seem to be helping, so why not seek some fresh advice? Like from high school students. Well, they just had their chance at a competition called the Euro Challenge. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the European Union sponsor this annual Wonk Fest, where high school freshmen and sophomores present their plans for solving Europe's economic problems. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore was a judge this year and delivers her verdict thusly.
John Chiarella is a high school sophomore from New Jersey. The way some 16-year-olds rave about hot video games, John riffs on interest rates and the euro. He's on a mission.
Me and, like, the rest of the group are going to try and find a way to save Europe from economic calamity.
He's not kidding.
Good morning. Welcome to today's meeting of the European Economic and Social Committee.
Chiarella and three other students at Rumson-Fairhaven Regional High School competed in the Euro Challenge. Their school has sent a team every year since 2008, when they won first place with a bold prediction about Greece.
We felt that they're going to be facing a sovereign debt crisis in the years ahead. That was 2008. So,
Joe Lanza is their coach. He recently heard from one of the students on that team who was kind of gloating.
Look where Greece is today. You know, they still didn't take any of our recommendations and they're still going to have problems in the streets. If they started the process 4 years ago, maybe they would be a little better shape.
Nearly 100 high schools sent their teenage Cassandras to the Euro Challenge this year. The Rumson team set out to solve the budget problems caused by Italy's aging population. One of their ideas was to cut government pension payments. John Chiarella ran it past his mom. It didn't go over well.
My mom, like, is a strong advocate of, like, social welfare, and she thinks that Europe does it very well. And I agree with her mostly, but, like, she has to realize that Italy spends 14% of their GDP on pensions.
At a weekend practice session before the competition, the coach, Joe Lanza, drilled the team.
Explain the one-size-fits-all monetary policy.
Chris Brodsky, a sophomore, showed off his mastery of the economic lingo.
Rising oil prices, which do what, Chris?
Postpone inputs such as hiring new workers and new orders for capital goods.
Chiarella says their classmates respond to all of this with blank expression.
A lot of my friends, like, are not really too into economics or history. One person asked me what I'm doing here, and I explained our whole, like, pension plan. What's the trouble in Europe? What's the trouble with Italy? And he's like, oh, so did you see Ghost Protocol yet?
The students vying to be Euro Challenge champions may be misfits while they're practicing, but the grind pays off. On the day they filed into the New York Fed for the competition, these teens sounded like future Treasury secretaries.
Well, in the U.S., when you default on a mortgage payment, your debt is essentially eliminated for the time being.
I sat up front as one of the three judges for the final round.
How much of the risk to the banking system that you've talked about comes from actual non-performing mortgages, and how much is from banks buying bundles of mortgage securities that they then couldn't resell?
All of us were dazzled by what the kids knew. Inflation, unemployment, economic bubbles.
So securitization wasn't used in Ireland. It was a very plain vanilla housing bubble.
Later on at the reception, Mia Ellis from Montclair High School explained how her team would solve the Irish housing crisis in expert terms.
We also suggested limiting or banning tracker mortgages in Ireland and in the future to prevent bubbles to limit building permits.
Her team won third place. Unfortunately, Rumson-Fairhaven didn't make it to the final round.
Our 2012 Euro Challenge champions, Ridgefield High School, Ridgefield, Connecticut. Congratulations.
The winners proposed tougher labor laws and higher taxes in Italy, something that might not fly politically. At the reception, the winning students joked about the best use of their prize money, $1,250 each.
Yeah, I think I'm going to save it.
Or, you know, just buy Italian debt and help out the country.
Even Europe's ambassador to the U.S. said the Eurozone could use the help. João de Valle Almeida offered up some gallows humor on that point.
This time last year, a number of people were saying that I wouldn't be here 1 year later for the simple reason that the euro would have dismantled. Well, I'm still here, and the European Union is still over there.
Nonetheless, the ambassador said he'd take some of the students' ideas back with him.
I'm sure you have found solutions that I'm ready to take over to Europe. I'll pay you some copyright.
It couldn't hurt, right? In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, for those of you whose dreams of NFL glory just missed the mark, you can have a piece of Super Bowl history. And I'm not talking T-shirts or caps or commemorative coins. No, this is the real deal, a ring. Former New York Giant Lawrence Taylor is auctioning off the one he got for being part of the winning team in Super Bowl 25. Bidding started today and runs through Saturday. Taylor is currently serving 6 years probation after pleading guilty to charges of sexual misconduct and patronizing an underage prostitute 2 years ago. The ring is valued somewhere between 75 and 100 grand, size 12, if you're interested. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 156 points, 1.25% to finish at 12,442. The NASDAQ dropped 60 points, 2.1% to wrap up at 2813. And the S&P 500 lost 19 points, 1.5%, ending at 1304. Our editors include John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.